Every year, Iowa Master Gardeners donate more than 100,000 hours of volunteer service in communities all over the state. This year, thanks to a new initiative, they'll also be helping to feed the hungry. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. This hour, I'll talk with Iowa Master Gardener Coordinator Denny Schrock about a new collaboration that will result in master gardeners growing needed produce for food banks. ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here, and he and Denny will answer your questions about the things you'd like to grow or grow better. Email questions to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and later this hour, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will be here to answer your questions. But first, every year, Iowa Master Gardeners do volunteer work all over the state, growing food and making communities more beautiful. A new initiative will also make it possible for Master Gardeners to help feed the hungry. Iowa Master Gardener Coordinator Denny Schrock is here. Hello, Denny.
Good morning, Charity. Great to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And Denny, first of all, for people who don't know much about Master Gardeners, what do Master Gardeners do?
Master Gardeners do a lot of things, but what we do is we train them with the basics of horticulture, and then they volunteer back in their communities educating others about gardening and horticulture, or as in this case, growing produce for others who are less fortunate and need that produce, teaching others about gardening, helping out in their communities.
And what makes a person a master gardener?
Well, it's a matter or a combination of learning and knowing a lot about plants and horticulture, as well as a willingness to help others. That's what we find are the two big things. They want to learn more about horticulture themselves, but then we also require that they teach others. So it's a education program on two ends. They learn about it, and then they teach it to others.
And what does somebody have to do to earn that title?
They go through a training program. It's about 40 hours of classroom instruction. Some of it is face-to-face training, but we do a lot of it over the internet or Adobe Connect webinar types of things. They also come to campus for a day of training on campus, and then they do this volunteer service as an internship. So 40 hours of volunteer service during their first year after taking the classroom portion of training. And then to continue their active status, they have to take at least 10 hours of continuing education per year. So some of them chose to this year go this route of the food production. And then additionally, continue on with at least 20 hours of volunteer service a year. We find that on average, they're volunteering at least 40 hours every year. So most of them are giving up a week of their work life to volunteer in the Master Gardener program.
How many Master Gardeners are there in Iowa?
We have approximately 2,400 active Master Gardeners, and that's been pretty consistent over at least the last 5 years. So we train several hundred new ones every year, but we seem to end up with that many leaving the program for various reasons. So it's been pretty constant at about 2,400 a year.
All right. And I mentioned this earlier in the program, but Master Gardeners in Iowa volunteer over 100,000 hours. I think it was over 120,000 hours for 2015. That's an incredible amount of time.
That is. And when we use the value of volunteer service, that means about $2.8 million worth of service to the state of Iowa that these Master Gardeners are donating on an annual basis. So a significant contribution, yes.
Now, this new collaboration is an idea to help Master Gardeners feed the hungry in Iowa. Obviously, there are master gardeners out there who have been doing this already, growing produce and donating it to food banks in Iowa. So it's not entirely new, right?
That's right. A lot of individual groups or individual master gardeners have been doing this on their own. But what we've done this year is we've partnered with the SNAP Ed program, that's a supplemental nutrition assistance program, to formalize the process a little bit more and perhaps generate more interest and thus more produce being produced. So the This is a federal grant funded program. So one, I was able to get a graduate assistant to help out with this. But also, we've got some mini grants that the Master Gardener groups are able to apply for these mini grants. We had 64 Master Gardener groups apply for these mini grants, and we're still in the process of reviewing those now to see which projects we're going to fund. We assume that a lot of them will go ahead even without the extra assistance we give through the mini grants of up to $1,000 each. But what we're looking for are projects that fall in one of three categories, either teaching others how to grow, connecting existing growers, whether it be backyard gardeners like people who are listening here, or farmers markets to their local food pantry or food bank, and then also growing themselves for the food bank. So I know we have Master Gardeners doing all sorts of those things that are already going to the food banks or food pantries.
But you're hoping that this will make it a much bigger part of the Master Gardener mission.
Yes. We want a big, much bigger part of the Master Gardener mission and formalize it and do a little bit better process of data collection to figure out exactly how much is being produced. I mean, we have some anecdotal evidence. For example, the Mills County Glenwood Giving Garden has been producing more than 4 tons of produce annually to their local food bank. We'd like to have that replicated all over the state so we can say, oh, yes, we've done this many tons of produce through the Master Gardener program this year.
Now, there are demonstration gardens on the Iowa State University research farms around the state. Will the 7 different demonstration gardens, will they be part of this project too?
That's right, Charity. So the demonstration gardens are sort of generally separate from the Master Gardener program, but their home demonstration gardens meant for the backyard gardener to come and get ideas of what they can do. And so that's one thing we're trying to make as part of this initiative as well, is that at all 7 of the home demonstration gardens this year, the theme is going to be growing produce for food pantries and food banks. So we'll be having vegetable gardens there growing. We checked with the Iowa Food Bank Association as to what produce they needed the most. You know, you can only use so many zucchinis, perhaps. But surprisingly to us, that was one thing that they put on their list, is they want more zucchini. So we've got green beans, tomatoes, cucumbers, carrots, potatoes, melons, onions, bell peppers, and sweet potatoes are going to be part of the home demonstration gardens. And so we're involving Master Gardeners there this year as sort of citizen scientists as well. They're going to be not only caring for the garden, but they're going to be taking careful records of which varieties are producing best. And so we then can turn around and say, okay, this variety of potato did better than this one. So if you're wanting to grow good ones in your backyard, that might be the way to go.
All right. So the whole initiative has 2 major benefits.
Yes.
Now, in connecting with the food banks around Iowa, why do you feel it's so important to get fresh produce into these food banks?
Well, in researching the program or deciding what we were going to do here, we found out that 1 in 8 Iowans is what we call food insecure. So 12% of Iowans don't have the sufficient quantity of nutritious food, and that's sort of the definition. They may have plenty of calories, but they're often not good quality calories, so high in fat and starch and so on, but not a lot of the vitamins and nutrients that come from vegetables. And in association with that poorer diet, those who are food insecure often have a higher level of diabetes, obesity, hypertension, and even in the children that are affected, we find that the children of food insecure families tend to have twice as high a need for special education needs. They're ill from school a lot more often. So we think if we can do some of these things to help bridge that gap, make their food calories more nutritious, that we can put a dent in some of those problems.
Now, I know that Master Gardeners have to go through a continuing education process. And over the winter, you've been doing some webinars that relate to this program. Is there still an opportunity for Master Gardeners to get involved if they haven't already signed on?
Yes, they certainly can get involved in the projects. The webinars were recorded so they could check with their local county extension office for the ability to log on and see those webinars and view it. They might also just check and see perhaps some of their other Master Gardener compatriots in their own county already have a project going, and they could sign on to that. We would also say that you don't have to be a Master Gardener to be involved, because a lot of the projects are going to be, Master Gardeners are going to be connecting growers to the local food pantries. So you might check with your local Master Gardener group if you're not a Master Gardener to see if they have a project going that they're going to be donating some produce to a local food pantry and make that part of your goal to grow more food for the food pantry.
Now, I know you said you were also reviewing the applications for these mini grants that go along with the program. Has that application process closed, or are you still taking applications?
Yeah, the application process just closed March 1st, and so we're planning to announce the winners in about 10 days or so. So we're reviewing those applications now. As I said, we had 64 applications. We anticipated giving out at least 20, maybe 25 or 30, depending on the amount that's requested in particular grants. So we hope to fund at least somewhere between a half and a third of the grant applications.
Now, the two of us have talked about the Master Gardener program on this program many times, but for people who are just hearing about it and thinking, oh, wait, maybe that's something I really want to get involved with, if you're interested, how do you find out about becoming a Master Gardener?
Well, we do the Master Gardener training once a year. It will begin in September of this year, so there's a bit of time to get involved with that. But we actually already have an online application available on our Master Gardener website, which is mastergardener.iastate.edu. That gets you to the homepage of the Master Gardener website. And then there you can click on a link that says Become a Master Gardener, and it'll take you to the online application as well as your address and phone contact information for your local county extension office, because that's really where it all happens at the local level. The online application is a statewide thing, but it has to be approved by your local county extension office, and oftentimes there may be an interview process involved with that as well.
What makes somebody a good candidate to become a Master Gardener?
Basically, there's really just two major factors that means that you probably will be a good Master Gardener. One is that you're very much interested in horticulture and gardening. You don't have to have a lot of knowledge already, but probably should be someone who has at least grown a plant or two. So you know some of the basics. But really the biggest thing is that you're interested in learning more, willing to learn more, put the time in to study a little bit. And then the second thing would be a willingness to help others, teach others about what you have learned, and provide that service back to the community.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment to answer your questions about the things you'd like to grow or grow better. With me this hour, Iowa Master Gardener Coordinator Denny Schrock and ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Duran will be joining us in just a moment. Things are turning green out there, so give us a call with your questions. 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Duran. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And of course, Iowa Master Gardener Coordinator Denny Schrock is here. And the phones are already lighting up. So let's go to Jeffrey on the line in Stone City. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hello. How are you today?
Good. What's your question?
I've got some blackberry bushes that 3 years ago we had a very nice harvest off of them. The last 2 years, though, sparse. I'm wondering what I could do to improve that.
Do you know the type or variety?
Well, no, I don't, but they're about as big as your thumb when they do come out. They're very good blackberries.
Okay. Most blackberries don't do well in Iowa, and that's because they bear fruit on the previous year's growth. And if we have a typical Iowa winter where we have temperatures of, let's say, minus 10, minus 20, those temperatures will destroy the canes pretty much, and so they don't produce fruit. It doesn't destroy the plants. They'll send up new shoots or canes in the spring, but they won't produce any fruit. So these varieties tend to produce well when we have a mild winter. So potentially this year, you might get a good crop because we've had a fairly mild winter. I would go out this spring in a few weeks and prune on any dead wood that you find and see what they do. There are some newer varieties from the University of Arkansas, and these newer varieties will actually bear in late summer, early fall on the current year's growth. So we'll get fruit even if they die back in the wintertime. And so you'll see things like Prime Jim, Prime Jan, Prime Arc 45, I believe. Those are all new varieties that produce fruit in late summer, early fall on the current year's growth. And so you might want to try those too.
Is there something I could do to protect the plant during the winter months, like pack straw around it or something?
Yeah, it's difficult to do. I mean, you could try that where you would bend the canes to the ground and maybe pin them to the ground and cover them with straw. But that's kind of hard to do, especially when the cane's going to be several feet in length. So you could try that, yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for your call, Jeffrey. And you can join the conversation, 866-780-9100. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Marcia is up next in Ankeny. Hi, Marcia.
Hi, I'm calling from Ankeny, where my son-in-law is anxious to amend all the dirt in our raised garden beds. We've used the garden bed for about 3 years. Been there, my husband and I have added some topsoil. But it's just, when it rains like it did last year, it just gets hard as a rock and seeds don't come up.
Okay. What I would probably do if I was constructing a raised bed, I would use a mix of good, well-drained soil, like a third of that, a third organic matter like compost, and then maybe a third coarse sand. So you have good drainage. The sand provides that. The organic matter holds the moisture, and then the actual soil has the nutrients. So it's a good combination, basically one-third good, well-drained, fertile soil, one-third organic matter, and one-third coarse sand.
The most important part is getting that organic matter in there. That's going to help break things up. You don't want to go with just sand, because if it's heavy clay-like soil and you add sand, you can end up with adobe bricks. So getting that organic matter in there is really critical. And if you're going to add sand, it needs to be a lot of sand to loosen it up. It shouldn't be just a little sand, or you may actually worsen the problem.
All right, Marcia, thanks a lot for your call. And a lot of people put in raised beds, and some of the benefits are pretty clear right on the surface. But why are these so popular? What are the benefits of raised beds?
Well, I think for some people, they think that's going to keep the weeds out, and not necessarily so. I think the big advantage would be if you have a very poor soil, a poorly drained soil. Rather than trying to grow things in that, just make a raised bed where you have better soil, better drainage.
All right. And they look nice, too.
Yes, they do. They can. Yes.
Yes. Right. And they're a little higher up, so you don't have to bend over quite as far to harvest things. So.
All right. And we've got a question up next about the Master Gardener program. Jan is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Charity.
Hi. What's your question?
I'd like to ask Denny if it's possible to do the Master Gardener training program online.
We don't have the option for doing Master Gardener training online. We just don't have that set up at this point. So we for several reasons. One, it takes a lot of effort to get that set up. But secondly, we think it's very important to have the group activities that we have involved in the Master Gardener program. It's not just an individual basis type of thing. So I know some states do offer Master Gardener training online, but we haven't moved in that direction yet. Perhaps we will eventually, but right now it's not one of our options.
All right, Jan, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, we've got Roger in Mayville. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I have a question. In our garden, and we have kind of a raised garden, and we put in a lot of, because our soil was really no good, so we filled it in and raised it up about 8 or 9 inches. And we've had a good garden there for a couple of years, but late last summer, we got stinging nettle in the garden and actually hurt my wife's hands. She had to go to the doctor and things. Now we're concerned. Some people have told us that it's almost impossible to get rid of, and she's wondering, should she even do anything with the garden? You know, if you put in Roundup or something like that, is it going to kill everything and therefore will not work for our vegetable gardens?
Well, stinging nettles are very tenacious, but they're not indestructible, so you can destroy them. I would try digging them out. I would put on gloves and try digging them out. If that doesn't work, you also have the option of using Roundup very selectively on those plants. But you just have to be a little bit patient, do a very thorough job, and you can do it, definitely.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck with that, Roger. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Pam is on the line in Davenport. Hi, Pam.
Hi. I've got a question about geraniums. Last year, I pulled out, and it was the year before, I pulled out my geraniums that were beautiful and just put them in a paper bag bare root.
Mm-hmm.
And by golly, I'd say 7/8 of them came back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were really great. What is the best time to put these in the dirt now?
I would, if you have them in storage, in cold storage yet, I would do this very soon. I would cut them back and basically cut them back to where you have solid green stems. Okay.
Okay.
Pot them up. Water them in nicely, and I'm going to say within like a week or 10 days, you should start to see some new growth. But basically cut out the dead growth near the tips and cut it back to solid green stem tissue and pot them up.
Okay, and do it now.
I would do it within the next week or 10 days, yes. So if you do it now or very soon, it should start to grow in a few days, and by early May, you should have a nice green healthy plant.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, they turned out really well last year, and I thought I would try to save them again another year. It saves a lot of money.
Right, it
and
does.
It's really rewarding.
And it's pretty easy.
It's really, yes, it is. Okay, well, thank you so
much.
Yeah,
Pam, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100. Laura is on the line in Mitchellville. Hello, Laura.
Hello, Charity. I have a question about bulbs. I walked out in my yard one day after the snow melted, and I had what looked like a map of a river with many tributaries. I looked it up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So is that voles? And if so, what can I do?
Yeah, it's typically voles, and they really only cause damage in the winter months. During the growing season, they're hiding in taller plants and plant debris and let's say thickets. And so they're not typically found in the yard. But during the winter months, when you have snow on the ground, then they can hide beneath the snow and feed on the grass plants. So that's when the damage typically occurs. Once the snow melts, they basically go elsewhere. So what I would do in that case, the damage to the turf usually is fairly minimal. I would just go out there and kind of rake the area, kind of clean it up a little bit, and usually the grass recovers by itself. Now, if it's not, you may have to overseed, but usually the damage is fairly minor and it does recover on its own.
All right, Laura, thanks a lot for your call, and I hope things go smoothly. Let's do a few email questions here. This one's from Judy in Cedar Rapids. I planted 5 bushes about 3 feet away from my neighbor's driveway. They're now about 5 feet tall and hang over that driveway. Can I transplant them, or should I just keep trimming the driveway side?
I think I would be inclined to transplant them if I could. They're not terribly big. We could probably still do it. The reason I say that would be if you don't, you're going to have to be pruning those on a fairly frequent basis. So I would be inclined to put the effort into moving them and where pruning shouldn't be that necessary. So I would go out sometime in the next, let's say, 2 or 3 weeks before they begin to leaf out. I'd probably take some twine and kind of tie it around them to kind of make them more compact. And then go out with a spade or shovel and dig them up and try to retain a nice ball of dirt around the root system, put them right back in the ground, and try to make sure that they have plenty of space. Now, if their mature height is, let's say, 5 feet, they probably should be at least 3 to 4 feet away from the driveway or sidewalk.
All right. Here's a question from Jody. I live in central Iowa and planted an Eskimo sunset maple tree a few years ago that I brought home from Kansas City. From what I understand, this tree is a cross between a poplar and maple. The leaves have a dappled green top and purple underside, which is why I just had to have it. As recommended, I planted it on the southeast side of my home to offer shelter from north winds and hot summer afternoons. It has thrived and now has a 6-inch diameter trunk. I want to trim some of the lowest branches back to the trunk. I have some branches that are 1 to 2 inches in diameter and wondered what the best time of year is to cut these. Being from the maple family, is spring the wrong time to trim?
Well, spring is a good time. You want to do that typically before they leaf out, but they will bleed quite a bit. And that kind of freaks out some people because they will lose quite a bit of sap for maybe a week or two. But don't worry, it's not harming the plant. So I would be inclined to do it within the next few weeks before it leaves out.
All right, let's get back to the phones. Ellen is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. Hi, I, for health reasons, I'm having to cut back the size of my flower gardens in my backyard. And I have an area about 12 to 16 feet by 8 feet that had mostly coneflowers, daisies, a lot of things that reseed them, you know, for themselves. And I've moved things, like I had some peonies and stuff like that. I've moved those out of there. But I want to know the best way to sort of muffle some of those seed-bearing flowers and, you know, so that I can just put grass seed in there.
Well, the best time to sow grass seed is basically late summer. What you might want to consider doing is just controlling the vegetation this spring and early summer. And you could do that one or two ways. One is by cultivation and hand pulling. The other possibly with Roundup or glyphosate. And then going out there around mid to late August and sowing your grass seed. So letting things come up this spring and early summer, and then destroying them and then seeding in late summer.
Okay, what about, like some people have said things like putting plastic sheeting down and leaving it there for a while. Does that really work? Or
It can, yes. What you may have to do is if you want to let the perennials kind of grow up a bit this spring for a bit and actually just mow them off a few times, because the most effective time for the plastic sheeting, of course, is in mid to late summer when the hottest temperatures occur.
Okay.
So just kind of keep it mowed down until, so maybe July, and then put the plastic sheeting on and kill it off at that point. You need to keep it down for at least 6 to 8 weeks. So that would be a pretty good timing if you start early July, have it all July and August, and then you'd be ready to prepare for your reseeding of turf in early September.
Okay. Well, thanks for your help.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Ellen, and I hope things go well. Tony is on the line. Hi, Tony.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
I got a question about a Concord grapevine. It's about 40 yards long. I'm looking to figure out the best way to trim this. The canopy on it's starting to get a little too thick. It produces a lot of grapes, but they're starting to get smaller, so I know I'm putting too much energy into the leaves.
Right. Is it grown on some?
Probably three. Pardon?
Is it grown on any type of a support or trellis? Is it?
Yes, it's on a trellis, and it's up off the ground about probably 3.5 feet.
So you have two wires or just one?
Yeah, two wires.
Okay.
There are three main roots, or three, I don't know the correct terminology for this, but there's three main grape roots that come up in this 40-yard vine. And out of the first one, there's three of them. Like I said, the first one, there's like three or four extra shoots coming out of the ground around the main one.
Mm-hmm.
Should those be trimmed out of there? They're much smaller.
I think I probably would.
Yeah. Most grapes are actually on own root. Concord probably was rooted, so it's probably not a different variety. But, yes, you really only want one main trunk or shoot coming out of there. So it sounds like you have essentially three separate plants coming out of the ground that have kind of all grown together. So what you probably want to do is sort of trim them as three separate plants rather than as one. So cut back all of those side cordons or shoots so that you have essentially six main shoots off of each of the three plants. It's not because you see you have three levels of wire. So that's what you're trying to train them along each of the side wires. So cut them back fairly severely. And you can cut grapes back really, really severely.
Right. You may
a
single plant may have vines with over 200 buds capable of producing fruit. And that's way, way too many. And typically when you have a single grape vine, when you're done pruning, there should be no more than 60 buds capable of producing fruit. So you have to do quite a bit of pruning on those.
All right, Tony, thanks a lot for your call. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It is Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me this hour, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran and Iowa Master Gardener Coordinator Denny Schrock. And you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also give us a call, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa Master Gardener Coordinator Denny Schrock and Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Duran, and you can join the conversation with your questions, too. talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org is our email address. Let's go to Pam on the line in Fort Dodge. Hi, Pam. Pam, are you there?
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Peonies. When do I transplant my peonies? That's all I need to know.
Yeah, it's fairly easy, and the best time is typically around mid to late September. And I would just go out there at that time. It's hard to do it in the spring because the new growth comes up so quick. It's very succulent, very easy to damage or break. And so it's hard to do in the spring, but in late summer, real easy. And you just go out there. Cut them back to ground level with your pruning shears, dig them up, and then replant immediately. And when you do so, position them at the same depth they were growing previously. They'll be fine.
Okay. I was hoping to do it this spring, but I guess I'll wait till this fall.
All right. Thanks a lot
for
your call, Pam. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Jim is on the line in East Moline. Hi, Jim.
Hi there.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, can I apply crabgrass preventer now, or do I need to wait?
It's way too early on that. Typically, I would say in your area, it would be around April 15th to May 1, typically. Now, if the weather stays warm, as it has been recently, then I would shoot more toward that April 15th date. And you just have to realize that Iowa in March, the weather in the Midwest, is very erratic. And so it's nice this week, but it could be snowing next weekend. So just keep that in mind and just wait until the weather is consistently warm. So I'd be shooting for April 15th if the weather stays nice the next few weeks.
And that's in southeast Iowa. In northwest Iowa, maybe May 15th. I looked at the long-range forecast, and late next week it's supposed to be back down in the 40s here in central Iowa anyway. So it is going to cool back down again, and you really don't want that crabgrass preventer on until it warms up, soil warming up to about 50 degrees.
All right, so it's a little too early.
Yeah, a little too early yet.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot for your call. Justin's on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Justin.
Hi. I had a question regarding, I'm kind of interested in planting a patch of native prairie grass in my backyard. Currently, there's just regular grass over it. Do I need to till that up to plant those seeds?
Yeah, you're going to have to kill the existing vegetation by some means before you can plant your native grasses and wildflowers. So you can do that by cultivation. And if you do that, it may take two or three attempts to do that. The other option would be something like Roundup, but you do need to keep basically kill the existing vegetation.
Okay. And it would be along the side where my neighbor's fence is, and they also have creeping Charlie that's consistently coming in. Would that be a hindrance to the native grasses and flowers?
Not once it gets established. It should not be a problem because that's more of a ground-hugging plant. So once you get the native grasses established, which may be 2 or 3 feet tall, you may have some ground ivy in there, but it's not going to take over. It's not going to smother out the native plants.
But you may have to be careful with it during the first 2 years because the native prairie grasses don't pop up in one season. It's basically a 3-year establishment period. So for those first couple of years, you're going to have to kind of watch and make sure that the creeping Charlie doesn't creep into your beds.
Okay, great. Well, thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for your call, Justin. Next up, we've got Brandon in Waterloo. Hi, Brandon.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. What's your question?
Just a quick question. My wife and I bought a new house, and it's on a really sandy lot, but I want to plant a garden. And I need to know, do I need to have dirt brought in? Do I need to bring in a bunch of fertilizer? I mean, I'm kind of lost on how to get started.
Okay, well, actually, sandy soil is great. You have good drainage that way. At least most likely you have good drainage. So the basic thing you want to do is add a lot of organic matter to that sand. So whether you actually build raised beds in a construction form or just add a lot of organic matter that raises the beds a little bit because it's mounded up with the extra organic matter, you should get really good results because it's that loose soil with the sand, and then the nutrients come from the organic matter as it breaks down. So you should be able to not have to bring in extra soil. Just add that organic matter, about a third by volume.
Right, and since you're calling from Waterloo, I'm assuming there probably is some type of yard waste site that does composting for Waterloo or Blackhawk County. And I would contact them and see if you can buy some compost from them as far as a bulk supply.
Oh, okay. Okay, I didn't know that was an option, I guess. So.
You're going to need a lot.
All right,
so.
Well, great.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, Brandon.
I appreciate you guys taking the time. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Cheryl in Pilot Mound. Hi, Cheryl.
Yes, hi. I was under the understanding that you could still prune back shrubs like gold leaf, spirea, or barberry through March. But I was concerned about the warm weather we've been having and that the ground may have really not been consistently frozen all winter. And I just wondered, is it still a good idea to do that? They really need it.
Yeah, it's okay. Basically, what you want to do on pruning deciduous shrubs, you want to prune those before they begin to leaf out. That's the main thing. And they shouldn't do that for at least another 2 or 3 weeks. So you're fine. So just do it whenever you have time.
Yep. Okay. Sounds great. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for your call. And next up, let's go to Sharon in Iowa City. Hi, Sharon. Sharon, are you there?
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Okay, I'm a Johnson County Master Gardener, and the Master Gardeners in Iowa City, we dig up perennial beds, and then we sell them at a flea market we have in May at the fairgrounds to supplement our program. So Ellen called several calls ago saying she was wanting to get rid of a perennial bed, so I thought that I might just put this little plug in. And if she so desires to have us come and dig some from that bed, then she needs to call the Johnson County Extension Office and ask for Shannon. And Shannon will get the message out to all of us.
Okay, well, that's great. And if anybody else has perennials to get rid of, you want to hear from them too?
Sure. You know, I mean, we have dig parties where we go out and dig somebody who's moving or, you know, getting rid of a bed, and then we resell them.
All right. Terrific. Thanks a lot. And thanks for your work, Sharon.
Thank you.
Yep. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. John is on the line in Madison County. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Hi. What's your question?
I have about some seed potatoes. I saved back some fingerling potatoes that I grew last year and put them in a paper bag in a cool, dark place in the basement. And yesterday I was down and opened it up and found that quite a few of them have sprouted, some a foot or more. Should I do anything about that, or can I just plant them as usual?
Well, I think what I'd probably do is those are extremely long. I would try to keep them in a very cool place, just above freezing. And before planting those, I would probably snap off the majority of that sprout, probably three-fourths of it, and plant as soon as you can at that point.
Okay. So just get rid of the long stuff and
Right. You just can't plant that huge sprout. So I would remove at least three-fourths of it.
Because most of the potatoes, you know, they have lots of eyes or buds on them. So if you break that first one that's come off, you'll force some of the secondary ones. So you actually will get lots more shoots coming up if you break out that main one that's come out first.
All right, John. Thanks a lot for your call. Let's do a couple email questions here. This is from Rick. I have stinging nettles advancing through my garden. I won't use petrochemicals or herbicides. I have a lot of room, more than 2 acres, so this area is now quarantined. Does solarization work? Is that the only organic option?
I think putting on a pair of gloves and digging them out is probably the best way of doing it. Solarization, boy... The weather in Iowa...
And what is solarization?
It's basically covering the area with maybe some black plastic.
Okay.
And then the heat, which builds up beneath that, would kill the plants. But the roots of the stinging nettle go quite deep, and I'm not sure it's going to go deep enough to destroy all the roots. And if you have a few roots that survive, they'll come back. So I think physically removing them would be the best bet.
All right.
It may depend a little bit on the extent. I mean, obviously, if he's got half an acre of the stinging nettles, that may be difficult to dig out. But, yeah, the solarization is probably not going to go deep enough to kill all of the stinging nettle roots. So if it's somewhat contained, yes, digging deeply to pull all those roots out is probably the best option if he doesn't want to use a herbicide.
Okay, well, and if he's got a half an acre, covering it in black plastic is going to be problematic too. So
right.
That sounds like a big challenge, and I hope it goes well. Rick, this question's from Emily. Is it okay to split and move my Stella de Oro daylilies now?
Yes. I mean, basically, daylilies can be moved almost any time the ground is workable. They're probably beginning to poke up a little bit. Most of my daylilies are starting the little shoots, so this is a great time before they get much more advanced in growth. So dig them up, divide them in clumps, and plant them back into whatever spacing she wants or whatever garden.
All right. Back to the phones. Julie is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a cherry tree that we planted 3 years ago. It's about 8 feet tall. It's got 9 main branches that started about a foot and a half, and we've never pruned it because I haven't been brave enough. So with some master advice, I will try to be brave whenever you tell me.
Okay, you have branches that begin 1.5 feet above the ground?
Correct.
Is that correct? Where are the majority of those branches? Are they higher up?
They're not. They're mostly a foot and a half to maybe 3 feet.
Okay. Well, they're awfully low.
Yes.
I would probably remove.
I just called 2 years ago.
I would probably remove the lowest one or two back to the trunk and leave the rest and see what develops this coming year. But it's awfully, awfully low as far as those branches, and I would try to get rid of one or two this year, maybe do it in steps and see how that plant performs this summer.
And my question is, do you know what kind of cherry tree? Is this a fruiting cherry tree or an ornamental cherry tree?
Oh, it's definitely a fruiting.
Okay.
We've had lovely cherries the last 2 seasons.
Okay. And is it a tart or sour cherry or a sweet cherry? Pie cherry?
It's kind of a pie cherry, yeah.
Okay.
I saved the tag for 2 seasons, and I went out in my yard today to try to find it, and I couldn't find it.
Okay. So, I mean, as a pie or tart cherry, you're going to want to prune it so that you sort of maximize the fruit production. So you need to try to create some of it an open canopy on the tree. So if you have any branches that are tending to grow towards the center of the tree, you want to prune those out. You may leave the main branch that's sort of heading outward, but if any of the side branches are heading into the center of the tree, remove those as well so that you open up the tree for better air circulation and light penetration for more fruiting. But as Richard said, you don't want to prune too much in one year, so pruning off a couple of those lower ones this year and then doing some of that thinning out type pruning would probably be all you'd want to do this year.
Okay. And is there any special treatment that you do once you cut it? I know I want to have a clean, sharp blade.
Clean, sharp blade, and then walk away. You don't want to put anything on those pruning cuts. Just let the sun and wind dry it out and seal it off. Don't put any pruning paint or sealer on it. It's better to let it seal sort of naturally.
All right. Very good.
Yep.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your call, Julie. Janet's up next in Coralville. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I have some very, very ugly seeds in my freezer. They're sharp. And they're called nightshade. They're not the deadly nightshade, but they're supposed to not be something the deer like. And when they come up, they're supposed to look just like little bits of grass, they say.
Do you know? Does this ring a bell?
We're looking at each other, and we're not sure exactly.
Well, it looks like a rolling round spike.
Okay. How big? As far as a dime, quarter?
Oh, like a walnut. My neighbors from Taft Speedway, where we used to live before the flood, and I love those nightshade. They just bloom at night, you know. And gave me some of the seeds on the plant, but they said, then I went back. I said, what do you do with them? And they said, well, put them in the freezer. I gave some to my son. I don't know. if you cut them while they're frozen.
I think what you might have is datura or Jimson weed. That is, it's a night blooming with a sort of a trumpet shaped flower on it. It is sometimes grown as an ornamental. It can also be very weedy in fields, so you want to make sure that you plant it where you want it and don't let it allow it to go seed too much. But that is a night bloomer, sometimes called moonflower too, because it has that sort of trumpet-shaped flower. So I suspect that that's maybe what you have. It's a very much a warm season type thing. You don't want to plant it this early yet. But once the temperature warms up, you could plant it directly outside, or if you want to start it indoors a few weeks early and then transplant it out where you want it, that would be the case.
Would she need to do anything else to prepare those seeds? Or
no,
just,
no. Okay. They will germinate on their own pretty readily. And she's right that the deer won't like them because it is a poisonous plant.
Okay. Here's a question from Barb and Percival. How far back do you cut knockout roses?
What I would do is go out probably toward the end of March, and I would simply prune out the dead wood. The dead wood will be brown in color. The live wood would be nice and green. Now, we've had a very mild winter, and so there may not be very much dead wood. In that case, if you want to, I would cut them back to maybe a foot or so above the ground.
All right. She also has the same question for limelight hydrangea bushes.
On that one, I would basically wait and see what leaves out, and then probably go out around mid-May and cut out everything that hasn't leafed out at that point.
All right. Well, thank you both so much for being here today. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Iowa Master Gardener Coordinator Denny Schrock.
Thank you, Charity.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. We will be back with Horticulture Day again next Friday. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Have a great weekend.